Senator who is Mark Hill to give his speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a very humbling experience to be the sole European representative at a conference such as this. And those of you who know me will understand that humility is not a virtue I often demonstrate. I've come here to listen and to learn, and I have been richly and fully fed in a series of universally high-quality presentations from a range of individuals, expert in their fields, covering subjects of interest, of controversy, and showing from their unique viewpoints things from which we can all learn. And I will make absolutely certain that I carry back to Europe, and in particular to the European Consortium for Church and State Research, of which I'm currently president, many of the shared experiences and shared information which has been disclosed today. My observations will be, I fear, from a European perspective, because that is a context in which I am versed, both as a scholar and as a practitioner. And it therefore follows that the points I make will be rather more general and less specific than those that we've been privileged to hear from other speakers. And again, I make no real apology for my Europeanness, because as Professor Durham told us at the outset, we're all African. Indeed, he was quoting Bishop Trevor Wamba, who said something else, namely that if you can't get your thoughts into two sentences, then they're not worth hearing. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've tried to get my thoughts into 8 points, and I've put them on a piece of paper, and they've been very kindly reproduced, and I hope you might have sight of them. I've also taken the liberty of numbering those 8 points, so that if you fall asleep at any stage in my presentation, then when you wake up, you'll have a rough idea of how far I've got. It might also be during the course of this presentation that I say something about a recent case. When I was a law student, I had a very elderly equity professor who would talk about recent cases. It then transpired that they were cases decided in the 1950s, long before any of us undergraduates had been born. This recent case is indeed recent. It was decided at 10 o'clock this morning, and I think I can proudly say that this is the first occasion it will be discussed in any academic institution in the continent of Africa. This is indeed a momentous event, ladies and gentlemen. You will be able to tell your children and your children's children that you were here. What I'm going to do, though, is not tell you when I'll deal with that case, as a penalty for those of you who do indeed fall asleep. And so to the paper. The paper deals broadly with issues of freedom of religion, and the written paper, which will be circulated in due course, speaks from my own experience of the United Kingdom with an established church, and how that interrelates to various other models of church and state in the European Union. But what I'd like to do is pose questions, because I've come here not to give answers, but to seek them. And the first question that I ask is, what in reality constitutes a dominant religion? Dr. Mdunde would tell us that religions are perhaps part of our multiple overlapping identities, that one can indeed be a Christian or a Muslim, and within that still have allegiance to a traditional African religion. Is dominance based upon mere numbers? Do you simply do a head count, and what comes out constitutes the dominant religion? Or is it a more subtle test? A test that depends on political or social influence. Has one particular faith-based organization, church, religion, call it what you will, come to have a political or a social dominance in a particular state which is not enjoyed by other religions. Equally for that matter, it may well be that there has been a change of demography or outlook over a number of years, and that current dominance in the 21st century does not truly reflect historical or cultural matters which have changed. Can a dominant religion justify itself objectively in the 21st century without recourse to historic anachronism? A United Kingdom census recently revealed that 59% of the United Kingdom claim themselves to be Christian. That compares with 72% who made the declaration 10 years ago when the census was last carried out. Sadly, we will not have a comparison 10 years from now, because the economic downturn and the period of austerity means that the government is not going to pay for a census in 10 years' time. Now, the final question under this section is whether the dominance of one religion is purely self-serving, or whether it can serve to benefit all religions, because by having a dominant religion giving a privileged place in political or public life, it allows the spiritual to have a greater position. Now, it's not normally my custom to quote from a head of state, but I want to take the liberty on this occasion to cite something that was said by Her Majesty the Queen at a Jubilee 60th anniversary lecture she gave at Lambeth Palace, the home of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And I quote her here, both as the monarch of Great Britain, the head of the Commonwealth, and of course the Supreme Governor of the Church of England. Forgive me, I won't try and impersonate her voice, because if that appears on the BYU website, I think it might be treasonable. She said as follows: "We should remind ourselves of the significant position of the Church of England in our nation's life. The concept of our established church is occasionally misunderstood, and I believe commonly underappreciated. Its role is not to defend Anglicanism to the exclusion of other religions. Instead, the church has a duty to protect the free practice of all faiths in this country. It certainly provides an identity and spiritual dimension for its own many adherents. But also, gently and assuredly, the Church of England has created an environment for other faith communities, and indeed people of no faith, to live freely. Woven into the fabric of this country, the Church has helped to build a better society, more and more in active cooperation for the common good with those of other faiths." Now, whether those high-minded principles in the United Kingdom can be in any way transported to Africa is a matter of some debate. Well, that deals, albeit briefly, with dominant religion. What about the question of what constitutes a minority religion? Again, is that measured purely in terms of the numbers by way of membership? Or again, does it deal with status, longevity, or in some ways, a de facto influence? It may be that a church which is small in number can nonetheless yield particular influence by dint of its link with government or through other ways of more subtle persuasion. Again, does the concept of registration, where one is required to register, facilitate freedom of religion or frustrate it? On the one hand, registration could be a mechanism for the conferral of benefits upon a church. A classic example might be the giving of tax breaks. On the other hand, it could be a way of regulating, suppressing, and controlling churches and other organisations. And I'm sure that's particularly the case with minority churches as opposed to those which are in some ways dominant. And again, it's when it's used in that oppressive way that one needs to have particular concerns. And again, the third point I make under this question relates to the interplay between freedom of belief as being an inherent personal quality that affects human dignity, and then on the other hand, collective freedom of religion, associational freedom of religion, which allows groups to flourish. Is it the case, you might consider, that in terms of associational freedom of religion, the greater the number of adherents a church may have, the greater the amount of liberty that church is afforded in order to manifest its religious practices? Now, I was very worried when I came to my third question, because Dean Quashigar seemed to be covering it in its totality during the course of his keynote address. And I sat there worrying, heaven forfend, that I might find myself with nothing to say. But largely through his very helpful presentation at the outset of this conference, what I'm now able to do is to import into my map of church-state relations the additional data I've gathered through his kind researches, and to apply these comparisons using what I've now learned about the African situation to what I'm far more familiar with in the continent of Europe. I shall get my colouring pens out on the flight home and make sure that task is properly dealt with. And in broad terms, although definitions change from one person to another, there are, I think, three major categories in relation to church-state relations. The one is a state church, for example, an established church, or even at the far end of the scale, a theocracy, or a church in which, or a state in which there is one predominant religion. Of course, England comes into that category, as do Denmark, Greece, Malta, and Finland. And I'm grateful for what I've learned here, that I can now give some African examples to that. Then there is the strict separation, again, the classic US model, whereby the state and the church function very much in their separate fields, and that there is no interrelation between the two. And the third category, somewhere between those two extremes on the spectrum, the idea of cooperation, that in some way, although no church is given particularly favoured treatment, there is a degree of a formal relationship between the state and a number of churches, and again, this is where registration can be a significant issue, and in the course of that cooperation between the organs of government and the churches themselves, social goods result in forms of education, in hospitals, and elsewhere. Now, there's a legal question here, and I think the legal question that we need to look at is the fourth one, whether a country can legitimately have a dominant or a favoured religion. And again, the European Court of Human Rights had occasion to look at this. I've put on the handout a very brief quotation from the judgment given in Lazio in Italy, a case concerning a crucifix erected on the classroom wall in a school. And again, what it says there is, beyond its religious meaning, the crucifix symbolized the principles and values which form the foundation of democracy and Western civilization. Curiously there, saying that the crucifix isn't merely a Christian symbol, but the crucifix goes further and symbolizes something about the foundation of European democracy and, as they put it, of Western civilization. And in giving an affirming judgment, Judge Bonello said this: a court of human rights has no right to disregard the cultural continuum of a nation's flow through time, nor to ignore what over centuries has served to mould and define the profile of a people. In other words, there is no universal one-size-fits-all doctrine of religious freedom and in the relation to the manifestation, for example, of religious symbols. Everything is determined on a delicate balancing exercise, taking fully into concern the matters that we deal with. Again, I consider what protection should be given to a state in relation to minority religions, whether there should be active support and whether there should be some system of genuine assistance to those which are in some way disadvantaged. Again, how does the church achieve practical engagement with minority religions? Well, the answer there, I think, lies more in the hands of the religions than it does in the hands of the state. And the question I ask then, firstly, is how does each of those religions find itself in a dialogue with the state? And one of the real difficulties with small minority religions is that there's no hierarchical structure pursuant to which there can be that dialogue. And that might be something that needs particular focus where traditional African religions are concerned. Then we get into the question of equal treatment, and I'll say one sentence only on this, and it is curiously, because of the interaction between Article 9, which is reproduced on the back of the sheet dealing with freedom of religion, and Article 14 dealing with non-discrimination, it can be in everybody's interests to have a state with a dominant religion, because every benefit conferred on that dominant religion must, ex hypothesi, be conferred on all religions, otherwise there's a violation of the Equality Directive in Article 14. I've been told to bring my comments to a close, at least you have in writing what I might otherwise have said with more time, and what I want to finish with are two quotations, because I would like to think that we can give some comfort to you, Mr. Dean, from the slightly pessimistic picture you might have painted yesterday, because I think there is real hope that we can work together with law and religion as an amalgam of cross disciplines which will work together the better to foster relationships in the field of education, in the field of welfare and healthcare. Those are the fusion of the two matters where good can come as a result. But that can only be achieved if each religion is autonomous and is not subject to state interference. My two quotations are these. One comes from an English High Court judge who said this: the attitude of the legislator to horse racing and football is akin to his attitude to religion, something to be encouraged, but not the business of government. And finally, I say, and I say this as a practicing attorney more than as a scholar, that religion and law are interesting, but law does not have all the answers. There's a quotation I want to give you, and I do it for two reasons. One, I was put in touch with a quotation by Professor John Whitty, an academic at Emory University, one of the co-sponsors of this conference, and two, because it's reproduced in the almost legendary Ecclesiastical Law Journal, which Professor Durham was kind enough to mention last night in association with the Oxford Law Journal. Law is not the answer to everything. This is a quote from an American jurist, Grant Gilmore, talking about issues of legal positivism. The better the society, the less law there will be. In heaven, there will be no law, and the lion will lie down with the lamb. In hell, there will be nothing but law, and due process will be meticulously observed. Thank you very much.